This is Island Waves, and you are listening to The Book Nook. Listening to Island Waves. Join us today as we journey along with Baroness Karen Blixen in her published memoirs, Out of Africa, published under the nom de plume Isaac Dennison. Come along on her journey. At the foot of the Nyon Hills. The equator runs across these highlands, some 100 miles to the north, and the farm lay at an altitude of over 6,000 feet. And in the daytime, you felt that you had got high up, near up by the sun. But the early mornings and evenings were limpid and restful, and the nights were cold. At one time, I tried to shoot with a bow and arrow. I was strong, but it was difficult for me to bend the Walter Robo bow which Farrar had gotten for me. Still, in the end, and after long practice, I became skillful as an archer. Commente was very small then, and he used to watch over me when I was shooting on the lawn and seemed doubtful about the undertaking. So one day he said to me, "Are you a Christian still when you are shooting with a bow?" I thought the Christian way was with a rifle. I showed him in my pictorial Bible an illustration to the tale of Hagar's son. And I quote, "And God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer." "Well," said Commente, "he was like you." Commente had a good hand with sick animals, and as with my native patients, he took out splinters from the dog's feet and even once cured one of them when it had been bitten by a snake. For some time now, I had in the house a stork with a broken wing. He was a decided character. He walked through the rooms, and when he came into my bedroom, he fought tremendous duels as with the rapier, with swaggering and flapping of wings, with his image in my looking glass. He followed Commente about between the houses, and it was impossible not to believe that he was deliberately imitating Commente's stiff, measured walk. Their legs were about the same thickness. The little native boys had an eye for caricature and shouted with joy when they saw the pair pass. Commente understood the joke, but he never paid much attention to what other people thought of him. He sent off the little boys to collect frogs for the stork in the bogs. It was also Commente who had charge of Lulu. Lulu came to my house from the woods as Commente had come in from the plains. To the east of my farm lie the Nyon Forest Reserve, which was then nearly all virgin forest. To my mind, it was a sad thing when the old forest was cut down and eucalyptus and grevillea planted in its place. It might have made a unique pleasure ground and park for Nairobi. An African native forest is a mysterious region. You ride into the depths of an old tapestry, in places faded and in others darkened with age, but marvelously rich in green shades. You cannot see the sky at all in there, but the sunlight plays in many strange ways, falling through the foliage. The gray fungus, like long drooping beards on the trees, and the creepers hanging down everywhere give a secretive, recondite air to the native forest. I used to ride there with Fra on Sundays when there was nothing to do on the farm, up and down the slopes and across the little winding forest streams. The air in the forest was cool like water and filled with the scent of plants, and in the beginning of the long rains, when the creepers flowered, you rode through sphere after sphere of fragrance. One kind of African daphne of the woods, which flowers with a small cream-colored sticky blossom, had an overwhelming sweet perfume like lilac and wild lily of the valley. Here and there, hollow tree stems were hung up like ropes of hide on a branch. The kikuyu hung them there to make the bees build in them and to get honey. Once we turned a corner in the forest, we saw a leopard sitting on the road, a sort of tapestry animal. Here, high above the ground, lived a garrulous, restless nation of gray little monkeys. Where a pack of monkeys had traveled over the road, the smell of them lingered for a long time in the air, a sort of dry and stale, mousy smell. And as you rode on, you would suddenly hear the rush and whiz over your head as the colony passed along on its own ways. If you kept still in the same place for some time, you might catch sight of one of the monkeys sitting immovable in a tree and little after discover that the whole forest round you was alive with his family. Places like fruits on the branches, gray or dark figures, they sat according to how the sunlight fell on them, all with their long tails hanging down behind them. They gave out a sort of peculiar sound, like a smacking kiss with a little cough to follow it. And from the ground, you saw the monkeys. They turned their heads from one side to the other in an affected manner, but if you made a sudden movement, they were all off in a second and you could follow the decreasing swash as they cleaved the treetops and disappeared into the woods like a shoal of fishes in the waves. In the Nyong Forest, I have also seen, on a narrow path through thick growth in the middle of a very hot day, the giant forest hog, a rare person indeed to meet. He came suddenly past me, with his wife and three young piglets, at a great speed, and the whole family looked like uniform, bigger and smaller figures cut out in dark paper against the sunlit green behind them. It was a glorious sight, like a reflection in a forest pool, like a thing that had happened 1,000 years ago. Lulu was a young antelope of the Bush Book tribe, which is perhaps the prettiest of all African antelopes. They are just a slightly bit bigger than the fallow deer, and they live in the woods or in the bush and are shy and fugitive, so that they are not seen as often as the antelopes of the plain. But the Nyong Hills and the surrounding country were good places for bushbuck, and if you had your camp in the hills and you were out hunting in the early morning or perhaps at sunset, you would see them come out of the bush into the glades, and as the rays of the sun fell upon them, their coat shone red as copper. This male had a pair of delicately turned horns. Lulu became a member of my household in this very way. I drove one morning from the farm to Nairobi. My mill on the farm had burnt down a short time before, and I had to drive into town many times to get the insurance settled and to get it paid out. In this early morning, I had my head filled with figures and estimates. As I came driving along the Nyong Road, a little group of Kikuyu children shouted to me from the roadside, and I saw that they were holding a very small bush book up for me to see. I knew that they would have found the thorn in the bush, and now they wanted me to sell it. But I was late for an appointment in Nairobi, and I had no thought for this sort of thing, so I drove on. And when I was coming back in the evening and was driving past the same place, there was again a great shout from the side of the road, and the small party was still there, a bit tired, of course, and very disappointed, for they may have tried to sell the farm to other people passing in by the course of the day. But keen now to get the deal through before the sun was down, they held up the farm high to tempt me. But I had had a long day in town and some adversity about the insurance, so that I did not care to stop or talk, and I just drove on past them. I did not even think of them when I was back in my house, and I dined and went to bed. The moment I had fallen asleep, I was woken up again by a great feeling of terror. The picture of the boys and the small buck, which had now collected and taken shape, stood out before me clearly as if it had been painted, and I sat up in my bed as appalled as if someone had been trying to choke me. What I thought would become of the fawn in the hands of the capturers, who had stood with it in the heat of the long day and held it up by its joined legs. It was surely too young to eat on its own. I myself had driven past it twice on the very same day, like the priest and the Levite in one, and had given no thought to it. And now, at this moment, where was it? I got up in a real panic and woke up all my houseboys. I told them that the fawn must be found and brought to me at once in the morning, or they would all of them get dismissed from my service. They were immediately up to the idea. Two of my boys had been in the car with me the same day and had not shown the slightest interest in the children or the fawn, and now they came forward and gave all the others a long list of details of the place and the hour and of the family of the boys. It was a moonlit night. My people all took off and spread into the landscape in a lively discussion of the situation. I heard them expatiating on the fact that they were all to be dismissed in case the bush book were not to be found. Early the next morning, when Farah brought me in my tea, Juma came in with him and carried the fawn in his arms. It was a female, and so we named her Lulu, which I was told was the Swahili word for a pearl. Lulu, by that time, was only as big as a cat, with large, quiet, purple eyes. She had such delicate legs that you feared they would not bear being folded up and unfolded again as she lay down and rose up. Her ears were smooth as silk and exceedingly expressive. Her nose was as black as a truffle. Her diminutive hoofs gave her all the air of a young Chinese lady of the old school with laced feet. It was a rare experience to hold such a perfect thing in your hands. Lulu soon adopted herself to the house and its inhabitants and behaved as if she were at home. During the first weeks, the polished floors in the rooms were a problem for her, and when she got outside the carpets, her legs went away from her to all four sides. It almost looked catastrophic, but she did not let it worry her much, and in the end, she learned how to walk on the bare floors with a sound like a succession of little angry finger taps. She was extraordinarily neat in all of her habits. She was headstrong already as a child, but when I stopped her from doing the things she wanted to do, she behaved as if she said anything rather than a scene. Kamante brought her up on a sucking bottle, and he also shut her up at night, for we had to be careful of her as the leopards were round up the house after nightfall. So she held to him and followed him about. and from time to time when he did not do what she wanted, she gave his thin little legs a hard butt with her young head, and she was so pretty that you could not help, when you looked upon the two together, seeing them as a new paradoxical illustration to the tale of the Beauty and the Beast. On the strength of this great beauty and gracefulness, Lulu obtained for herself a commanding position in the house and was treated with respect by all. In Africa, I never had dogs of any other breed other than the Scotch Deerhound. There is no more noble or gracious kind of dog. They must have lived for centuries with men to understand and fall in with our life and its conditions the way they do. You will also find them in the old paintings and tapestries, as they have in themselves a tendency to change by their looks and manners, also by their surroundings into tapestry. They bring with them a feudal atmosphere. The first of my tribe of deerhounds, who is named Dusk, had been given to me as a wedding present and had come out with me when I began my life in Africa on the Mayflower, so to say. He was a gallant, generous character. He accompanied me when, during the first few months of the war, I did transport for the governor with ox wagons in the Maasai Reserve. But a couple of years later, he was killed by a zebra. And by that time that Lulu came to live in my home, I had two of his sons there. The Scotch Deerhound went well with the African scenery and the African native. It may be due to the altitude, the highland melody in the river, or all three, for he did not look so harmonious at sea level in Mombasa. It was as if the great spare landscape with the plains, the hills, the rivers was not complete until the deerhounds were also in it. All of the deerhounds were great hunters and had more nose than my greyhounds, but they hunted by sight, and it was a highly wonderful thing to see the two of them working together. I took them with me when I was not out riding in the game reserve, which I was not allowed to do, and they would spread the herds of zebra and wildebeest all over the plain as if the stars of heaven running wild over the sky. But when I was out in the Maasai Reserve shooting, I never lost a wounded head of game if I had the deerhounds with me. They looked well in the native forest too, dark gray in their somber green shades. One of them in here all by himself killed a big old male baboon, and in the fight had his nose bitten straight through, which did spoil his noble profile, but by everybody on the farm was considered an honorable scar, for the baboons are destructive beasts and the natives detest them. The deerhounds were very wise and knew who amongst my houseboys were Mohammedans and not allowed to touch the dogs. During my first years in Africa, I had a Somali gum bearer named Ismail who died while I was out there. He was one of the old-time gun bearers, and there are no such people today. He had been brought up by the great old big game hunters of the beginning of the century, when all of Africa was a real deer park. His acquaintance with civilization was entirely of the hunting fields, and he spoke in English of the hunting world so that he could talk of my big and my young rifle. After Ismaili had gone back to Somaliland, I had a letter from him which was addressed to the Lioness Blixen and opened, "Honorable Lioness." Ismail was a strict Mohammedan and would not for the life of him touch a dog, which caused him much worry in his profession. But he made an exception with Dusk and never minded my taking him with us on our mule trap, and he would even let Dusk sleep in his tent. For Dusk, he said, would know a Mohammedan when he saw him, and he would never touch him. Indeed, Ismail assured me, Dusk could see at once who was a sincere Mohammedan at heart. He once said to me, "I know now that the Dusk is of the same tribe as of you yourself." He laughs. He laughs at those people. Now, my dogs understood Lulu's power and position in the house. The arrogance of the great hunters was like water with her. She pushed them away from the milk bone and from their favorite places in front of the fire. I had tied a small bell on a rein around Lulu's neck, and there came a time when the dogs, when they heard the jingle of it approaching through the rooms, would get up resignedly from their warm beds by the fireplace and go and lie down in some other part of the room. Still, nobody could be of gentler demeanor than Lulu was when she came to me and lie down in the manner of a perfect lady who demurely gathers her skirts about her and will be in no one's way. She drank the milk with a polite pernickety mien as if she had been pressed by an overkind hostess. She insisted on being scratched behind the ears in a pretty forbearing way, like a young wife who pertly permits her husband a caress. And when Lulu grew up, and she stood in the flower of her young loveliness, she was a slim, delicately rounded doe from her nose to her toes, and unbelievably beautiful. She looked like a minutely painted illustration to Heine's songs of the wise and gentle gazelles by the flow of the river Ganges. But Lulu was not really gentle. She had the so-called devil in her. She had to the highest degree the feminine trait of appearing to be exclusively on the defensive, concentrated on guarding the integrity of her being, when she was really, with every force in her, bent upon the offensive. Against whom? Against the whole world. Her moods grew beyond control or computation, and she would go for my horses if she was displeased with them. I remembered old Hagenbach in Hamburg, who had said of all the animal races, the carnivores included, the deer are the least to be relied on, and that you may trust a leopard, but if you must trust a young stag, sooner or later, he falls upon you in the rear. Lulu was the pride of the house, even when she behaved like a real shameless young coquette, but we did not make her happy. Sometimes she walked away from the house for hours or for an entire afternoon. Sometimes, when the spirits came upon her and her discontent with her surroundings reached a climax, she would perform, for the satisfaction of her own heart, on the lawn in front of the house, a sort of war dance which looked like a brief zigzag prayer to Satan himself. Oh, Lulu, I thought, I knew that you are marvelously strong and that you can leap higher than your own height. You are furious with us now. You wish that we were all dead, and indeed we should also be if you would bother to kill us. But the trouble is not as you think now, that we have put up obstacles too high for you to jump. And how could we possibly do that, you great leaper? Is it that we have put up no obstacles at all? The great strength which is in you, Lulu, and the obstacles are within you as well, and the thing is that fullness of time has not yet come. One evening, Lulu did not come home, and we looked out for her in vain for over a week. This was a hard blow to us all. A clear note had gone out of the house, and it seemed no better than the other houses. I thought of the leopards by the river, and one evening I talked about them to Commente. As usual, he waited some time before he answered, to digest my lack of insight. It was not till a few days later that he approached me upon the matter. "You believe that Lulu is dead, Sabu," he said. I did not like to say so straight out, but I told him I was wondering why she did not come back. "Lulu," said Commente, "is not dead, but she is married." This was pleasant, surprising news, and I asked him how he knew of it. "Oh, yes," he said, "she is married. She lives in the forest with her Bwana, her husband or master, but she has not forgotten the people. Most mornings she is coming back to the house, I lay out crushed maize to her at the back of the kitchen, and then just before the sun comes up, she walks round there from the woods and eats it. Her husband is with her, but he is afraid of the people because he has never, ever known them. He stands below the big white tree by the other side of the lawn, but up to the house he dares not come. I told Kamante to come and fetch me when he next saw Lulu. And a few days later, before sunrise, he came and called me out. It was a lovely morning. The last stars withdrew while we were waiting, and the sky was clear and serene, but the world in which we walked was somber still and profoundly silent. The grass was wet. Down by the trees where the ground sloped, it gleamed with the dew like dim silver. The air of the morning was cold. It had that sort of twinge in it in which the northern countries means that the frost is not far away. However often you make the experience, I thought, it is still impossible to believe in the coolness and shade that the heat of the sun and the glare of the sky in a few short hours' time will be so hard to bear. The gray mists lie upon the hills, strangely taking shape from them. It would be bitterly cold on the buffalo if they were about there now, grazing on the hillside as in a cloud. The great vault over our heads was gradually filled with clarity like a glass with wine. Suddenly, gently, the summits of the hill caught the first sunlight and blushed. And slowly, as the earth leaned towards the sun, the grassy slopes at the foot of the mountain turned a delicate gold, and the Maasai woods lower down. And now the tops of the hills of the tall trees in the forest on our side of the river blushed like copper. This was the hour for the flight of the big purple wood pigeons, which roosted by the other side of the river and came over to feed on the Cape chestnuts in my forest. They were here only for a short season in the year. The birds came surprisingly fast, like a cavalry attack of the air. And for this reason, the morning pigeon shooting on the farm was popular with my friends in Nairobi. To be out by the house in time just as the sun rose, they used to come out so early that they rounded my drive with the lamps of their cars still lighted. Standing like this in the limpid shadow, looking up towards the golden heights and the clear sky, you would get the feeling that you were in reality walking along the bottom of the sea with the currents running by you, and that you were gazing up towards the surface of the ocean. A bird began to sing, and then I heard, a little way off in the forest, the tinkling of a bell. Yes, it was a joy. Lulu was back, and about in her old places. It came nearer, and I could follow her movements by its rhythm. She was walking, stopping, walking on again. And turning round one of the boys' huts brought her upon us. It suddenly became an unusual and amusing thing to see a bush book so close to the house. She stood immovable now. She seemed to be prepared for the sight of Kamante, but not for that of me. But she did not make off. She looked at me without fear and without any remembrance of our skirmishes. All of the parts of her own ingratitude in running away without warning. Lulu of the woods was a superior, independent being. A change of heart had come upon her. She was in possession. If I had happened to have known a young princess in exile, and while she was still a pretender to the throne and had met her again in her full queenly estate after she had come into her rights, our meeting would have had the same character. Lulu showed no more meanness of heart than King Louis-Philippe did when he declared that the King of France did not remember the grudges of the Duke of Orleans. She was now the complete Lulu. The spirit of offensive had gone from her. For whom and why would she attack? She was standing quietly on her divine rights. She remembered me enough to feel that I was nothing to be afraid of. And for a minute she gazed at me. Her purple smoky eyes were absolutely without expression and did not wink. And I remembered that the gods or goddesses never wink, and felt that I was face to face with the ox-eyed Hera. She lightly nipped a leaf of grass as she passed by me, made one pretty little leap, and walked on to the back of the kitchen where Commente had spread maize upon the ground. Commente touched my arm with one finger and then pointed it towards the woods. And as I followed the direction, I saw under a tall cape chestnut tree a male bush book, a small tawny silhouette at the outskirts of the forest with a fine pair of horns, immovable like a tree stem. Commente observed him for some time and then laughed. "Look here now," he said. "Lulu has explained to her husband that there is nothing up here by the houses to be afraid of, but all at the same time, he dares not come. Every morning he thinks that today he will come all the way, but then when he sees the house and the people, he gets a cold stone in his stomach. This is a common thing in the native world and often gets in the way of the work on the farm, and then he stops by the tree." For a very long time, Lulu came up to the house in the early mornings. Her clear bell announced that the sun was upon the hills. I used to lie in bed and wait for it. Sometimes she stayed away for a week or two and we missed her and began to talk of the people who went to shoot in the hills. But then again, my houseboys announced, "Lulu is here." A few times more, I also saw the bush book's silhouette amongst the trees, but Commente had been right, and he never collected enough courage to come all the way up to the house. One day, as I came back from Nairobi, Commente was keeping watch for me outside the kitchen door and stepped forward, much excited to tell me that Lulu had been back to the farm the very same day and had her Toto, her baby, with her. Some days later, I myself had the honor to meet her amongst the boys' huts, much on the alert and not at all to be trifled with a very small fawn at her heels, as delicately tortive in his movements as Lulu had been when we first knew her. This was just after the long rains, and during those summer months, Lulu was to be found near the houses in the afternoon as well as at daybreak. She would even be round there at midday, keeping in the shadow of the huts. Lulu's fawn was not afraid of the dogs and would let them sniff him all over, but he could not get used to the natives, or to me for that matter, and even if we tried to get hold of him, the mother and the child were off. Lulu herself would never, ever, after her long absence from the house, come so near to any of us that we could touch her. And in other ways, she was friendly. She understood that we wanted to look at her fawn, and she would take a piece of sugar cane from an outstretched hand. She walked up the open dining room door and gazed thoughtfully into the twilight of the rooms, but she never, ever again crossed the threshold. She had, by this time, lost her bell and came and went away in silence. My houseboy suggested that I should let them catch Lulu's fawn and keep him as we had once kept Lulu, but I thought it would make a boorish return for Lulu's elegant confidence in us. It also seemed to me that the free union between my house and the antelope was a very rare, honorable thing. Lulu came in from the wild world to show that we were on good terms with it, and she made my house one with the African landscape so that nobody could tell where the one stopped and the other began. Lulu knew the place of the giant forest hog's lair and had seen the rhino copulate. In Africa, there is a cuckoo which sings in the middle of the hot days in the midst of the forest like the sonorous heartbeat of the world. I had never had the luck to see her, neither had anyone that I knew, for nobody could tell me how she looked. But Lulu had perhaps walked on a narrow green deer path just under the branch on which the cuckoo was sitting. I was then reading a book about the old great empress of China and how after the birth of her son, young Yanahola came on a visit to her old home. She set forth from the Forbidden City in her golden green-hung palanquin. My house, I thought, was now like the house of the young empress's father and mother. The two antelopes, the big and the small, were round by my house all that summer, sometimes even during intervals of a fortnight or 3 weeks between their visits, but at other times we saw them every day. In the beginning of the next rainy season, my houseboys told me that Lulu had come back with a new fawn. I did not see the fawn myself, for by this time they did not come up quite as close to the house, but later, I saw the three bush books together in the forest. The league between Lulu and her family and my house lasted for many, many years. The bush books were often in the neighborhood of the house, and they came out of the woods and went back again as if my grounds were a province of the wild country. They came mostly just before sunset and first move amongst the trees like delicate dark silhouettes on the dark green. But when they stepped out to graze on the lawn in the light of the afternoon sun, their coats shone like copper. One of them was Lulu, for she came up near to the house and walked about sedately, pricking her ears when a car arrived or when we opened a window and the dogs would know her. She became darker in color with age. Once I came driving up in front of my house with a friend and found three bush books on the terrace there round the salt that was laid out for my cows. It was a curious thing that apart from the first big bush book, Lulu's Bwana, who had stood under the Cape Chestnut with his head up, no male bush book was amongst the antelopes that came to my home. It seemed that we had to do with a forest matriarchy. The hunters and naturalists of the colony took an interest in my bush books, and the game warden drove out to the farm to see them, and he did see them here. A correspondent wrote about them in the East African Standard. 3 years in which Lulu and her people came round to my house were the happiest of my life in Africa. And for that very reason, I came to look upon my acquaintance with the forest antelopes as a great boon and a token of friendship from Africa. All the country was in it, good omens, old covenants, a song. Make haste, my beloved, and be thou like to a roe or to a young hart upon the mountain of spices. During my last years in Africa, I saw less and less of Lulu and her family. Within the year before I went away, I do not think they ever came. Things had changed. South of my farmland had been given out to farmers and the forest had been cleared and houses built. Tractors were heaving up and down where the glades had been. Many of the new settlers were keen sportsmen and the rifle sang in the landscape. I believe that the game withdrew to the west and went into the woods of the Maasai Reserve. I do not know how long an antelope lives, and probably Lulu has died a long time ago. Often, very often, in the quiet hours of daybreak, I have dreamed that I have heard Lulu's clear bell, and in my sleep, my heart has run full of joy. I have woken up expecting something very strange and sweet to happen just now in a moment. And when I have then lain and thought of Lulu, I have wondered if, in her life in the woods, she ever dreamed of the bell. Would there pass in her mind like shadows upon water, pictures of people and dogs? If I know a song of Africa, I thought, of the giraffe and the African new moon lying on her back, of the plows in the fields and the sweaty faces of the coffee pickers, does Africa know a song of me? Would the air over the plain quiver with the color that I had on, or the children invent a game in which my name or the full moon throw a shadow over the gravel of the drive that was like me? Or would the eagles of Nyong look out for me? I have not heard from Lulu since I went away, but Kamante I have heard, and from my other houseboys in Africa. It is not more than a month since I last got a letter from him. But these communications from Africa come to me in a strange, unreal way, and more like shadows or mirages than like news of a reality. For Kamante cannot write, and he does not know English. When he or my other people take into their heads to send me their tidings, they go to one of the professional Indian or native letter writers who are sitting with their writing desk, paper, pen, and ink, outside the post offices, and explain to them what shall be in the letter. The professional writers do not know much English either, and can hardly be said to know how to write, but they themselves believe that they can. To show off their skill, they enrich the letters with a number of flourishes which makes them difficult to decipher. They also have a habit of writing the letters in three or four different kinds of ink, and whatever their motive is for this, it does give the impression that they are short of ink and are squeezing the last drop out of a number of ink bottles. From all these efforts come the sort of messages that people got from the Oracle of Delphi. There is a depth in the letters that I get. You feel that there is some vital communication which has been heavy on the heart of the sender, which has made him walk in a long way from the Kikuyu Reserve to the post office. But it is wrapped up in darkness. The cheap and dirty little sheet of paper that, when it comes to you, has traveled many thousand miles, seems to speak and speak and even scream to you. But it tells you nothing at all. Kamante, however, in this as in most other ways, is different from other people. As a correspondent, he has a manner of his own. He puts three or four letters into the same envelope and has them marked, first letter, second letter, and so on. They all contain the same things repeated over and over again. Perhaps he wants to make a deeper impression upon me by repetition. He had that way in talking when there was anything that he particularly wanted me to understand or to remember. Perhaps it is difficult for him to break off when he feels that he has got into contact with a friend at such a great distance. Kamante writes that he has been out of work for a very long time. I was not surprised to hear of it, for he was really caviar to the general. I had educated a royal cook and left him in a new colony. It was with him a case of open sesame. Now the word has been lost and the stone has closed for good round the mystic treasures that he had in it. Where the great chef walked in deep thought, full of knowledge, nobody sees anything but a little bandy-legged Kikuyu, a dwarf with a flat, still face. What has Kamante got to say when he walks into Nairobi, takes up his stand before the greedy, supercilious Indian letter writer, and expounds to him a message that is to go halfway round the world? The lines are crooked, and there is no order in the phrases of the letter. But Kamante has in him a greatness of soul of which the people who knew him will still hear the note in the cracked, distorted music, even as an echo on the harp of the herd boy David. This is a second letter. I will not forget you, Musabi, Honorable Musabi. Now all of your servants, they never are glad because you is from the country. If we was bird, we fly and see you, then we turn. Then your old farm, it was good place for cows, small calf, black people. Now they had no anything, cows, goat, sheep, they have no anything. Now all bad people, they enjoy in their heart, because your old servant, they come poor people now. Now God know in his heart all this to help sometimes your servant. And in a third letter, Commente gives an example of the way in which the native can say a handsome thing to you, as he writes, write and tell us if you turn. We think you turn, because why? We think that you shall never can forget us, because why? We think that you remembered still all our face and our mother names. A white man who wanted to say a pretty thing to you would write, I can never forget you. The African says, we do not think of you, that you can ever forget us. You've been listening to Out of Africa, the letters from Karen Blixen on her journey. Join us again on the Book Nook, here on Island Waves, the voice of Prince Edward Island.